Birds are such a wonder to watch, especially after a long, cold winter, and seeing those beautiful and gorgeous warblers out there, sure a sight for sore eyes. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for spending your holiday with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you're having a nice Memorial Day weekend. Our guests are, I think, are going to make it even all the more fun because we have Bill Volkert with us today. Bill has been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years. He spent 27 years as a naturalist at Horican Marsh. And Bill, always a great pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's great to be with you again.
And with me in the studio, Kim Grevels, an avian biologist. She coordinates the Wisconsin Stopover Initiative at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And Kim, good to have you back with us as well.
Thank you so much for having me on today, Larry. And I want to thank Bill, too, for inviting me to join him today. I'm quite honored to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, you're welcome. It's great to share the airways with you.
Yep, and I'm really glad to have you both here. And for our listeners, as you listen in, maybe you've got an interesting sighting. Maybe you have a question about birds. I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you've got some cool pictures, photos of birds, please post them up on my Facebook page. I know we've had people post photos and say, what is that bird? Well, a lot of times we can figure out what it is if we've got a nice photo. That's at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. So I hope you'll go there as well. Now, as we think about this spring, we've had, this long, cold winter. Do you think it had much of an impact on our birds? Or what impact did it have? And maybe I'll start with you, Kim.
Well, when the birds if we're talking about migrating birds, the short-distance migrants will be somewhat affected by environmental conditions and will migrate accordingly. If temperatures and conditions are too cold and rainy, they will stay further south and come in later. We saw them come in really early a few years back when we had that very early spring. Mm-hmm. But the long-distance migrants, their migration is based more on the length of light during the day, and so they will not be affected by the weather we're having up here. They have no way to know down in South America, Central America, what our weather is up here.
Bill, comment?
Well, I think the short of it is spring was slow to get here and so were the birds. But a little more detail, the first arrivals are usually our Canada geese, the sandhill cranes, red-winged blackbirds. They need to feed in the uplands, and since the snow was so persistent, there was not that available feeding on the open ground for them. They were slow to get here. The next big wave of birds we tend to get, those are the waterfowl. Well, there again, the ice was slow to get out, so the ducks, the grebes, the loons, they were also behind schedule. And as Kim said, some of our songbirds, they were held up, especially during April when we would have expected to see birds here. They were behind schedule. So some of the early migrants were a little slow. By about the third week of April, we had a little bit of a warm-up. It almost looked as if we were going to break out of this. We had a day or two where it hit 70. A little bit of a push of birds came in, and then we just shut down and went back into it again for a long time. We had, again, some warm weather around early May. We had a little bit of a influx of birds. I would say the good news is that as long and cold as the spring was, it was a darn good thing that the birds made it, say, all the way up to southern Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Missouri, and then stayed there. Yeah. I think it might have been a little bit more stressful had they come up expecting that spring was coming on a warm day or two, and then to be all but frozen out then for weeks on end. And the biggest problem is those songbirds are feeding on insects, and we just did not have the hatch. Yeah. So there was very little food here. And normally we expect to see Baltimore Orioles and hummingbirds, everybody's favorites, right around those first few days of May. Some of those didn't get here until about the 8th or the 10th of May. So they did make their way north, as Kim was saying, with the timing of that they were getting the signals in the tropics. But then along the way, it's the weather that really pushes them. And we had that persistent north wind, which just was not an aid to them. And it wasn't until about the 10th of May that the birds really started coming in. And again, it stayed cold for us. for bird watchers, I think it was an extraordinary year. Everything was behind schedule, but when they did get here, yeah, the birds were stressed. There wasn't a lot of food, but there also weren't the leaves, so you could really see things out there. And the warblers just stacked up here. There were some places where they were just dripping from the trees, it seemed. The typical uplands, the Kettle Moraine, the Baraboo Hills, I did some birding there. The birds weren't there in big numbers because the oaks and maples and hickories hadn't even budded out yet. But if you got into lowlands where the willows, box elder, and some of the other shrubs and trees had leafed out more than anywhere else, it was like an oasis. The birds had just moved into there in tremendous numbers. I did a birdathon out at Horicon, and I ran into a number of photographers. They said they'd never seen warblers so thick or also so visible, because the birds that tend to feed way up in the treetops, like the Blackburnian warbler, the black-throated green Perula warbler, there was no food up there. So I saw some of these birds, which you're normally craning your neck to see them at the treetops, 3 feet off the ground. It was just really kind of an interesting year that way, and provided for some spectacular birding and photography.
That's really cool. Jim in Russ County has a question, I think, relating to migration. So let's go there. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Your expert there mentioned waves of birds, and midwinter we had big waves of snow buntings, lots and lots of them. I believe now they would be up in the Arctic or close to it. We saw more robins in large bunches than ever, and they like our high bush cranberries. But last year they wiped. Totally ate the berries. This year they didn't. There were a lot left. And we did have some cedar waxwings that came through earlier, and then I hadn't seen them for 2 or 3 weeks, and now the cedar waxwings are back gobbling up those high bush cranberries. So I was kind of interested, why would the waxwings, and we see the birds every day from our windows, why would the waxwings, we'd see them for a couple weeks, and then they'd be gone for, as I said, 3 weeks, and now they're back again.
Kim, what about that?
Well, cedar waxwings move around a lot throughout the winter. They are migratory, but they are here throughout the year, and they move from place to place. They have their food preferences. Some years they'll come and they'll just devour all the berries on my mountain ash tree. Every year they eat all the arils on the red cedars. So other years they come by, they just eat the arils and they move on. It's what's available out on the landscape. They're very much taking advantage of their favorite foods, and they have a good sense of where to go and what's available.
Mm. Very cool. Thank you, Jim, for that report. I appreciate it very much. Annalisa in Green Bay has a question. Hi, Annalisa.
Hi. I have a question about the quality and the consistency of bird seed. And I also have a question about suet that has pepper in it and is supposed to deter squirrels. It seems to be deterring the birds, too. But we've been buying some bird seed that seemed like it had sunflower and safflower and some of the other things, and the last couple of bags just have not had all that much quality stuff in it. And we're kind of puzzled about the inconsistency of this particular brand. So I wonder if you have any insights about what to look for. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. We'll probably get comments from both Bill and Kim. Bill, you want to start?
Well, for bird seed, yeah, there are a lot of different dealers out there, some really specializing in bird seed and bird seed mixes and blends and varieties of different kinds of seeds. And others, I think, do it as a bit of a sideline. Like, I guess, any food, even your own food, you want to look at the ingredients. There are filler materials, such as the red millets in particular. Birds don't tend to eat it all that much, but people put it in there. It provides bulk. It doesn't really do a lot in terms of bird preferences. And then you also have to watch a little bit for spoilage of seed, particularly thistle. Stores that don't have a lot of turnover in their inventory, some of that seed can sit on a shelf for a long time. Sunflower seed, I find, that can sit for quite a while. It doesn't seem to matter all that much. But thistle seed can spoil, and we've had experiences here, and I know we've had calls in the past. If the birds aren't touching it, dump it. If they're just not looking at it for a week or two on end, it's probably spoiled, and they seem to be able to sense that. The bigger concern, of course, is seed that gets moist and has a fungus or a mold on it. That can also be very unhealthy for the birds. And as far as the suet, yeah, watch the stuff that's got the pepper or heavy salt or something like that. It's probably not that good for the birds either.
Kim, a comment?
Oh, I agree with what Bill said, and we have lots of feeders at my house. I tend to be, I don't use mixes at all. I provide oil, black oil sunflower seeds. I think it's the highest quality sunflower seed for the winter birds and even migrating birds that are seed eaters. I also provide thistle and keep a watch on that mold. It can happen so easily. And then suet, I find that the higher quality, it's worth it to pay just a little bit more, get a higher quality suet to put out there, and I wouldn't get one that has squirrel deterrent. I would use cages and baffles to deter the squirrels.
There we go. Thank you very much for those questions. And those are questions I think a lot of folks probably had at this time of the year. Christina in Glenwood City, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you. Well, I am delighted to report that I have a winged haven at my place. I have over 20 orioles, the same number of rose-breasted grosbeaks, 6 indigo buntings, and just a kaleidoscope of color. And my exciting sighting is both a red-headed woodpecker and a scarlet tanager, interestingly, were coming to my grape jelly feeder. And I've got pictures to prove. And then my question is, I live between Menominee and Baldwin, so it's western Wisconsin, and I got a purple martin house and pole, but I'm wondering if it's too late to attract them. I want to avoid sparrows nesting in there, and what advice do you have regarding the purple martins?
Okay, Bill, comment?
Some of the most colorful ones, so yeah, it sounds like a real haven. Good for you. And I think that's what everybody's looking for in spring are not only the summer birds coming back, but especially those brilliant orioles and the rose-breasted grosbeaks. They certainly add a lot to the color out there. So that's really nice to be able to see that.
I had a scarlet tanager at my oriole feeder, too. I have no orioles feeding, but I had the scarlet tanager.
Well, I think they're a little stressed. Those tend to be birds that are up in the treetops, and there's just not a lot of food. Now the leaves are coming out, and there's insects up there. So I think that they were arriving pretty close to on the clock when they should get here, but spring wasn't ready for them. So being a little stressed, they were coming down. I actually had a chance to photograph a couple of scarlet tanagers as I was driving around the Baraboo Hills area and out toward Wyalusing a little more than a week ago. And these birds were 3 feet off the ground. So normally you're shooting underneath the bird trying to get a decent angle. These are just straight on. So, yeah, they're looking for alternate foods. It's not unusual for them. As far as the purple martins are concerned, it's probably not too late. You can get it out there. Those that are traditional are certainly already on the houses. And you can see if you can at least lure some for interest. There may be a few at least scouted out and take a look. They probably won't be nesting at this point. I'm sure that they pretty well homed in on a traditional sites. But here's a bird that is in trouble. Populations have been declining, and they're in the eastern United States 100% dependent on the housing we provide for them. So purple martins do need good landlords, people who are going to be able to attract them and keep them, and who are going to make the stringent effort to keep the competitors out, the house sparrows and the starlings. The best I could recommend is to go to the Purple Martin websites for Minnesota has a very good one, and also the Purple Martin Conservation Association. Take a look at the recommendations that they offer for the placement of it, for the maintenance and management of those Purple Martin houses. And basically, I think the rule is they're very difficult to attract, but they're easy to lose. And that's the problem that where normally people in the past had martins here and there with very little maintenance. A lot of these have been taken over by the house sparrows and starlings, and they've moved out. We've been losing colonies, and not a lot of people are making a good concerted effort to start new colonies, and we do need that. They need our help.
Bill Volker, naturalist and retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, one of our guests today. Kim Grevels, who is an avian biologist and coordinator of the Wisconsin Stopover Initiative at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, our guest here on this Memorial Day. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, back from Paris, from Gay Paris, answering the phones for you on this Memorial Day here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Doing a little spring bird watching today, or at least talking about spring bird watching with our two guests, Bill Volker and Kim Grevels. Kim with the Department of Natural Resources. Bill, retired wildlife educator from Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Great to have him along. You can join in. There's actually an open line at 1-800-642-1234. And Kim, you were kind of excited about an earlier call, the gal who had all those birds in her yard.
Yes, this is just a wonderful thing to hear, that this woman has a terrific stopover site in her backyard. And that's kind of what the Wisconsin Stopover Initiative is all about. We are promoting just the little things that people can do in their yards to help migratory birds. And it sounds like she's doing a lot, that she has that variety and those particular species coming to her yard and in the numbers that they are occurring. And so we are documenting what people are doing in their backyards to provide stopover habitat for migratory birds. And we would love to get in touch with that person and perhaps come out and take some photos and get some information from her about her management tactics.
Well, that would be wonderful. Maybe, you have a website. She could probably go to that, but she could also just maybe call and leave a, it's sometimes hard for Judith to be able to take numbers down. But if she calls back, if you'd call back, I'm sure we could get your number and Kim could give you a call and sort of work something out.
Or she could call me at the DNR at 608-264-8594.
Wait a minute, 608-264-8594 for Kim Grevels. Okay, so one way or the other, you'd like to talk to her.
I would.
Okay. That sounds like a plan. Let's go to Karen in Edgerton next. Karen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Happy Memorial Day. I have a question about wood ducks and tree swallows. I have, for the past few years, had successful wood duck hatchings. And this year, the two wood duck houses have been occupied, and suddenly the tree swallows were terribly interested, looking in, sitting on top. And now, I don't know if the young'uns have fledged, but the tree swallows have taken over the wood duck house. And I'm wondering, in order to have future wood ducks and not tree swallows, do I take the houses down now, or is it okay for the tree swallows now to occupy it?
Well, I would say that you probably have a lack of cavities in the neighborhood. Natural cavities, whether they're the rotten holes in trees that occur or old woodpecker holes, can be somewhat limited. They usually occur in dead or dying trees, and they also, because those trees are rotting out, they don't tend to last that long. Commonly, those trees will be standing for a few years, and they rot at the base and fall down. So your tree swallow certainly doesn't need anything as big as a wood duck box as a nesting site, but it tells me that there's nothing else available. It's certainly more than enough room. And I would say rather than taking down your houses, supplement it with some additional houses more suitable for bluebirds and tree swallows. Give them a place that's more suited to their size and needs, and that way you've got a little bit of space for either of them. So,
actually, I bought a little house for them.
Okay.
They flew, checked it out, and ignored it and went back to the wood duck house. and there are holes in the trees that the squirrels used to nest in. So My concern is, will the wood ducks come back next year if the tree swallows have taken over?
Oh, I would think so. They are fairly traditional with it, and if they are successful in rearing young, they certainly will come back. And usually your wood ducks are starting to set up house or shop about the same time or maybe a little earlier than the tree swallows. Considering the spring that we're having, this may be a little early for wood ducks to have already hatched out their young. It's not impossible. This is normally about the time as we get toward the end of May and early June. We see the young jumping out, but this was a late spring for it. So it is possible the wood ducks have already hatched their young out and have jumped out, and the tree swallows are moving in afterwards. It's hard to tell with ducks if they are successful or not in nesting, because it's just a few minutes at early in the morning. Usually the young gather up, they jump out, and then they swim off somewhere into the thickets where there's shelter and food, and you never really know unless you happen to be there within those couple of minutes' time when everybody is jumping out whether it's been successful. I check my wood duck boxes in wintertime when I can get out on the ice, and you can look for eggshell fragments and the membranes, and you get an idea of how many were actually successfully hatched. A little more difficult to do during summer unless you get out there with a canoe over water.
Right. Absolutely. Karen, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. We have a Facebook comment from Kevin and a photo as well. He said, I had a rare sighting of a lazuli bunting around my feeder in rural Grant County last week. And coincidentally, there were several indigo buntings around at the same time, which is pretty cool. And a Facebook comment from, and a nice photo, by the way, as accompanying that as well. A Facebook question from Diane, just bought a house in Madison. I'd like to attract more birds to my yard, especially the warblers in spring and fall. Anything I can plant that birds like? And Kim, there's probably a lot of things she could do.
Yes, there are a lot of things. And a lot depends on what where you're located and what how wet your soil is and what will be good. But on most loamy soils, it's good to plant things like chokecherry or serviceberry, gooseberry, any of the native understory species, viburnums, especially arrowwood or maple leaf viburnum. The birds really like those. And they're good to provide foraging opportunities in the spring with native insects that are attracted to those shrubs, as well as providing berries, which are high energy food sources for birds in the, when they're migrating in the fall. If your soil is a little wetter, you might go with the willows or with red osier dogwood. Silky dogwood is another one that would do well in a wet situation. And then oak trees, we know, are very important in the spring. They tend to leaf out at the different oak species will leaf out at different times. So if you have a slow year, one species will be used by the birds. If you have an early year, another species will be ready when the birds are coming, where they're just leafing out, and they tend to attract a lot of lepidopteran larvae, and that's your butterflies and moths, and that's a really high-energy food source in the spring.
There we go. And Dee and Amory has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Hi, Dee.
Hi. I have a question. About 2 weeks ago, on my driveway, I live in Amory, just outside of town, and across the street from the river, so I have, you know, a lot of different species. But about 2 weeks ago, on my driveway, probably covering about, maybe 25 feet, I had about 100 of the smallest yellow birds I've ever seen. I looked them up in the book, and there's no yellow bird without some color on it. These had absolutely no color. And they were feeding on my gravel driveway, and I can't imagine what was there that they, you know, that many of them could eat. I looked in the book, and there's no yellow bird that is all yellow that I could find. And they were only about maybe an inch and a half in size.
Inch and a half? Holy
yep, the tiniest,
moly.
The tiniest birds I ever saw.
Yeah, I would guess probably more around 4 inches, which is the size of our warblers. The one that comes to my mind that is mostly yellow is yellow warbler. The males have chestnut striping on the breast.
These had absolutely no other color on them, and there must have been 100 of them.
I'm wondering if it wasn't some of the warblers feeding right on the ground where the insects were. I watched a chestnut-sided warbler, which is normally in the middle to a little bit higher in the trees, literally on the ground looking for insects in the grass, and I have never seen that bird on the ground. They feed among the vegetation, but there was no food there.
Yeah,
I'm
wondering if
your driveway that you didn't have some exposure that was heating it up, getting some insects out. And, of course, there are insects that live in the soil and in the ground as well as in the leaves. Well, if they're not in the leaves, the birds are coming down, and you may have had a big wave of the warblers coming through. As I mentioned earlier, we saw some little woodlots and forest groves that were just loaded with warblers where they could find the food. So it might have been what you had was a big concentration of them looking for food wherever they could find it in such an unusual late year.
Did you get a photo of them, Dee?
No, I didn't. By the time I got back there, they were moved on. I have a lot of wild finches in my birch tree all the time.
Right. The goldfinch, of course, has that black on the wing for the male and dark gray for the female. But they're seed eaters for the most part. I'm guessing probably warblers looking for food on the ground in this very late year.
Thanks, Dee. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have a comment from Daniel. He's been seeing a lot more loons this year than in past years. Hearing many more territorial calls, seeing a lot of mating display between what I believe are new pairs. These observations are in many lakes from Rusk and Chippewa and Barron counties to Sawyer, Washburn, and Ashland counties. So that's kind of good news, isn't it?
I'll let Kim comment on that.
Yeah, Kim?
So, could you repeat that, Larry?
Oh, it was loons. I'm sorry.
Loons, yeah.
Yeah, this Daniel has been seeing so many more loons, and Daniel gets around quite a bit. So, Rusk County, Chippewa County, Barron County Lakes, Sawyer, Washburn, and Ashland counties, just seeing a lot more and more territorial calling, a lot of mating display going on, wondering if we have an uptick now in loons.
Well, the common loon has certainly made a comeback from several years ago when it was on the state listed species as threatened, and now it's not listed anymore. We took it off, about 6-7 years ago because of the Loon Watch program that the Sigurd Olsen Institute implemented over the last couple of decades, where they have these loon ranger volunteers who live on lakes, and they take responsibility for monitoring the loons and helping with nesting structures and helping educate people who recreate on the lakes to avoid doing recreation that can impact their populations. And so we have seen a recovery of the common loon because of that. It's been a wonderful thing. They face other challenges, such as we had a big die-off of them on Lake Michigan a few years back on the Michigan side when they got hit with botulinum. It was a poisoning from a toxin that was in the lake produced by a bacteria. And I don't know that they've uncovered the source of that, but there was a big die-off at that time, but it wasn't enough to impact the population overall. I know here in Madison this spring we had a great time watching the loons out on Lake Monona with their doing mating displays, and there were many, many loons that came through Madison this year.
My understanding that the die-off was from the toxin in the exotic goby fish.
Oh, that's right, yes.
And we think that some of those were loons coming out of Canada. So, yeah, it was a big die-off, but it didn't seem to hit Wisconsin or Michigan populations real significantly. And the biologists around the Great Lakes were watching a bit to see if there was going to be a reoccurrence. Apparently that didn't happen. I didn't see anything in the news of any other major die-off. So maybe it was a single episode, hopefully. And, yeah, the loons are not only coming back, but I understand that they're starting to show up on lakes where they hadn't been for years. So, in other words, the adults are coming back, rearing young. Those young are surviving and starting to set up new territories. So, good news for the loons.
Yeah, I had a friend who was at the Monona Terrace with the binoculars and just counting the loons, counted 65 loons on Lake Monona one day. 65.
Amazing.
And, you know, you can see with a good pair of binoculars and up there on the Monona Terrace, you get a really good view of a good share of the lake. And Yeah, he was excited. 65.
Well, again, another event where the loons made it that far for spring. The ice was still on the lakes further north, and they're just stacking up on the open water that was available.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Paul in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. A question about photography, but especially nowadays with so many wonderful pictures being taken by amateurs, and they go up on Facebook and the web, and many of them are really quite thrilling. I'm wondering if there's been some technological advance that allows people like myself to take pictures of birds that we would have been struggling to reach in years past.
Hmm.
Well, I shoot pictures of birds. I've used them for education programs for many years, and I try to get a good collection, and every year I try to add something to it. I think the big technological breakthrough for me has been digital photography. I don't pay for film anymore. So half of it is if you shoot enough pictures, eventually something will turn out. And also with the high-resolution cameras these days, you're getting 14, 16 megapixels or more. The thing that you have there is if you get a clear picture to begin with, you can crop it. So in other words, you can take a picture from a bit of a distance and then zoom in on the computer and still have it as a fairly sharp image before it becomes too pixelated on you. The real trick, though, is you've got to be in the right place at the right time and have a cooperative bird. And I think the real fun and challenge is always shooting the songbirds, especially the colorful warblers. Those things never sit still very long, so it's always nice to see a picture of a bird that looks like he's just posed and just sitting there, and you realize that he stopped for just a split second when you happen to get that picture. I think the real trick is get out there when the birds are around. This spring was nice because the leaves weren't out to hide the birds, and just shoot as you can and as opportunity presents itself. And I always tell people that I'm not the best photographer, but if I shoot enough, something will eventually turn out.
Yeah. I have a good friend, Kurt. He's at a feeder, would set up, set his camera out by the feeder and in a good position, and then he could remotely take photos with it so he'd get away from it. So he'd get these really nice close-ups. The birds would come right into the, sometimes land on the camera. But he'd get some really good pictures that way, really.
Another little trick to do is we like to have nice pictures of birds that are attracted to the feeders, but if you always have them on the feeder, it gets a little distracting, the photo. Put some branches and perches up right next to it. Give them a place to sit.
Yeah.
They jump back and forth from the feeder and create your own perch and background for it, and then either hide yourself with a blind or remote camera so they're not scared from you as a photographer. That'll certainly help to get some good, clear pictures.
You know, while I'm thinking about it here, Kim, you and Bill are going to be hosting a workshop coming up this coming Saturday, if I'm not mistaken. Is it on Grosbeaks? Grosbeaks?
It's called Grosbeaks Galore, Birds on Your Landscape Workshop. And it's a workshop that's designed to help landowners to know what to do, what native plants to put in their yard, and other things they can do to help migratory birds use their yard and to attract them to their yard during migration. And Bill will be one of our speakers talking about the wonderful work that he and his wife Connie have done on their property in the Kettle Moraine. And we have Laura Erickson giving the keynote address, and she's a famous radio personality, as you know. And we also have Vicki Piaskowski, who is retired now from Birds Without Borders, but she did a lot of work with migratory birds and research on migratory birds and what they forage on in Wisconsin, and she will be sharing that knowledge with these people. We'll also be doing outdoor field trips, and this is an all-day event on Saturday, May 31st, at the Northern Great Lakes Visitor Center. And if people want to sign up, they should call me soon at 608-264-8594. Registration closes this Wednesday.
And what a nice place. That's a great place, jumping off point in Ashland. That's for sure at the center. The number is 608-264-8594, 264-8594, the number if you want to get involved in Grosbeaks Galore. And it's not only Grosbeaks, but a whole lot of other birds, too.
Whole lot of other birds, too.
And I know, Kim, you've got to move on. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's a real pleasure. Kim, you fractured your wrist, did you not?
Yes, in April. I'm one of my first outings to go bird watching just for fun on a Saturday morning. I fell backwards over a log while trying to see some blue-gray gnatcatchers up in an oak tree. And yes, I'm in a splint and will be so for a few more weeks yet.
Yeah, so some health-related issues, but we really appreciate you taking the time. I hope we have a chance to do this again.
Thank you so much, Larry, and thank you too, Bill. It was a great honor to be on today, and I really appreciate this opportunity. Hope folks will come to our workshop next week and meet Bill and me in person.
Yeah, and we'll be plugging that again more than once as the time goes on. Thank you so much, Kim. Kim Grebels is an avian biologist and the coordinator for the Wisconsin Stopover Initiative through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and our guest today. Bill Volkert, also our guest, naturalist, retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. And Bill's going to stay with us. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today, talking birds on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at birds and bird watching on this Memorial Day holiday with Bill Volkert, naturalist, retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Always great to have Bill with us. Boy, how many years have we been doing this together, Bill?
I don't even know.
I was trying to remember, recall.
I did our first program back, I believe, about 87, 88.
Yeah, I think.
Then you started doing the holiday shows with Sam Robbins.
Yeah.
And then Noel Cutright and I picked up after Sam passed away, which was in the year 2000. We had our first show together than Memorial Day in 2000. So, yeah, it's been a long run.
But a good one, that's for sure.
I love it, Ed. Thanks always for doing this.
Well, it's fun. And Jeff and Nina has a question or a comment. I think it should be a comment. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry and Bill. I want to confirm the late arrival of the Purple Martins. I've been tracking them at my station since 08, and 08, 09, and 010, they came in April 17th, 22nd, and 22nd. And then last year, which was a very cold April, they didn't arrive until May 4th. But this year, I was getting nervous they weren't even going to show up, but they finally showed up on May 20th, almost a month later than normal.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? I usually think of Purple Martins somewhere between, I look around the middle of April, 15th to the 20th, right?
Yep.
Around there is pretty much the normal time. Yeah, this is extraordinary, and you're wondering if some of these birds were ever going to get here.
They showed up the day the lake flies showed up. That's not a coincidence.
Yeah, good timing on their part.
Oh,
good
thank
for
you
for keeping an eye on them and helping out the Martins. As I said earlier, they really rely on us. They need our help, and they need good landlords to take care of them.
Yeah,
well, thank you for the show.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Pete in Redfield, Reedfield, I believe it is, Wisconsin. Hi, Pete.
Hi, I've got a bird that I'm thinking it's a woodpecker, but he's up on top of my fireplace, the little metal thing on top. There's nothing there to eat, and it's like he's a little drummer boy. He's just getting a kick out of rat-a-tat padding up there, and I'm wondering, you know, what to do about it, actually.
Is he doing it right on the metal cover or on the wood?
Right on the metal cover.
Okay.
Yeah, it can drive you nuts if they get on the wrong spot. Chimneys, gutters, things like that are not that unusual. Probably downy woodpecker would be my guess. Woodpeckers are not that vocal, and especially the downy and hairy woodpeckers, they don't have a lot of variations in their calls. So most birds will produce calls that they do throughout the year for warning, for food, for staying in contact with others of their kind. Those are the simple notes that we hear out of birds. Songs are what the males produce in springtime to declare a territory and seek a mate. Well, woodpeckers, because they're not good vocalists, don't produce songs for the most part. The red-bellied woodpecker is a little more vocal than the others, and so is the flicker. But so what they do is they drum. And so that drilling that you hear out in the woods is not looking for insects. When the woodpeckers are looking for insects, they're tapping on the wood and picking at it to extract the food. This drumming that you hear is actually substitute for a song. So they're trying to announce that this is their territory. And they usually look for a tree that's got a nice hollow resonance that just carries that sound across the woods. Well, sometimes a chimney or something else works for them. And so that's what you've got, is he's trying to establish a territory and trying to make a little bit of noise out there, literally. The wrong place, the wrong time, such as right at sunrise on a weekend you might want to sleep in, and on a metal chimney, it can get a little aggravating. And there the best deterrent is to try to either put up something that can keep the bird away, some flagging or something that moves in the wind, or a physical barrier for a while, just to keep them out of there and have them find something a little more suitable.
Yeah, I tried a hawk decoy, and he just stood right next to it, and like king of the neighborhood, rat-a-tat-tatting away. Like, this is definitely my spot. So, thanks so much.
If it's too annoying for you, he'll probably carry on for a couple more weeks, and he should give up. Every once in a while, there are a few birds that will continue through the summer, but normally it's spring, early summer that they do that and get into the nesting season. They should give up pretty soon.
There you go.
Otherwise, some deterrence.
Thanks, Pete.
Well, thanks again, yes.
Appreciate it very much. We have, go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show if you want to see some pretty cool pictures that we have of birds. Bill, I don't know if you have access to it
now. I've been looking at them, and I thought maybe we should get to a few of these since people were kind enough to post them, and I thought we could help them out. First of all, Kevin, who called earlier about the lazuli bunting in Grant County, this is a very rare bird for Wisconsin. We've had a few records over the years, but it's a bird more of the western and southwestern states. This is something that needs good documentation. The picture is certainly appreciated, but if he would take the time to go to the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website and go to their rare species report form and submit the date, the time, place, and conditions that he saw the bird and attach that same photo, that would make it a formal documentation so we have a record of who saw the bird, where and when, and that would be something that's an accepted record then for the state. Since it is seen so rarely, this is something that we, if you would take the extra time, could use some documentation. Also, the picture from Tom. This is from Tom in Poinette. The little bird that he's got, take a close look. He's all yellow in the belly, coming up the throat, gray around the head with white rings around the eye. This is a Nashville warbler. Nashville warblers nest in bogs in northern Wisconsin and southern Canada. And so he's in Poinette. I get him here in the Kettle Moraine. These are passage migrants in southern Wisconsin. They're just moving through. We do have a few bogs in southern Wisconsin where these birds do hang out, but mostly they're in the northern part of the state. And then, of course, a beautiful picture of scarlet tanager. As I said earlier, these birds were really visible and very cooperative just because there wasn't that much food up there where they normally hang out in the treetops. They were really visible this year and made quite a show of themselves.
Absolutely. Some great photos. And I hope if you're near your, as you listen to the show today, as we talk with Bill, if you're near your computer, go to the Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and click on the photos and the comments, and you'll see some pretty nice pictures. Ken and Elroy, thank you for calling. Let's get you on. Hello.
Hi. Those of us who watch birds here in southern Juneau County, Elroy, Waniwok, Union Center, saw a massive arrival of orchard orioles along with the Baltimore Orioles, and none of us had ever seen orchard orioles here over the past 50 years. Has anybody else reported an influx of orchard orioles?
I'd like to hear from others if there are reports out there, but I can tell you this, that orchard orioles for many years were sort of the southern counterpart or cousin to our Baltimore Oriole. So for Wisconsin, Baltimore Oriole is the mainstay, and you more or less had to go south of Wisconsin to really get into the homeland of the orchard oriole. It's still really the heart of the range, but as that population has been increasing, there are more and more sightings of this bird in Wisconsin and even nest records. And over the last, 15 years or so, I have seen orchard orioles go from a fairly uncommon bird for southern Wisconsin in particular to a regular resident bird in a number of areas. And this spring, I went out, did some bird watching in the middle of May here, about the last week and a half or two, and I came across orchard orioles in four different locations, including my backyard. I had a first-year male here, which is a little more difficult to identify. But, yeah, it's a bird that's really been increasing in numbers and its distribution around the state. And where, as I say, it used to be a rare sight, it's not that uncommon anymore. So, yeah, good news for that bird.
Yeah.
Would climate change have anything to do with it?
That may, but, you know, climate change is something that's very slow to have an impact on the environment. Where population changes, those tend to take place in much shorter time frames. And, yeah, over the long run, if we start to see changes in the environment, we may see those southern birds start to move north if the forest types are changing as a result of changing climate. But here what we're really seeing is just an increase in the bird population, and with that, more of them are spreading out and they're heading our way, in the same way that we had the comment earlier about more loon sightings. It's just simply the loons are doing better, and so more birds out there, more chance to see them.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Ken. Thank you for calling. Richard in Reedsburg, hi.
Hi. This is, my friend is a big hunter and spends hours and hours in the woods, and this year he was in his turkey blind with his grandson, and they saw a gray and white bird, kind of big, the size of a mourning dove, with a tail that was 12 or 16 inches long and undulated as it flew. Now, the only thing I could think of was the scissor-tailed flycatcher, which is nowhere around here, but it could be an accidental, and you were just talking about accidentals, and was wondering if it could have been that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have one other story just quick I'd like to tell after that.
Okay.
Well, actually, scissor tail flycatcher is even on the checklist of birds for Wisconsin. So
okay.
It has been seen over the years enough times that it is a somewhat expected sighting. Yes, the birds are primarily from, say, about Missouri down through Texas, Arkansas, those southern states. You drive across Texas, you'll see them sitting on the barbed wire fences, and it's a very common bird. When I go down in our wintertime to Nicaragua, that's the wintering site, I see them in the evening flying by in the hundreds. So it's a large population. It seems that this is a bird also where numbers have been increasing and doing fairly well, and it is a bird that does show up in Wisconsin periodically. More or less a stray or a wander, winds up here a little bit beyond its normal range, and about every year or two, we do get scissor-tail flycatcher in Wisconsin somewhere. So, yeah, very
likely. Okay, well, I didn't see it, but, well, there's another one that probably was one, and it was after a storm about a month ago, so.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always possible if the wind carried it.
Yeah, he was in his blind with his grandson, first time hunting turkeys, and a big male saw the other male and came down the hill full speed running, and they both flew up in the air and met in a huge crash in the middle of the air with their claws flying and fighting each other, and it was great.
Quite a sight.
For a first-time hunter, that must have been something.
Yeah, that'd be good for a 50th-time hunter.
Yeah, remember right. What to see if you spend time
guy,
on the woods.
Mike hunts every year at least one or two or three turkey permits, and he's never seen that before.
Oh.
So.
Great story,
okay,
Richard. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate that call for sure. And Mike in Elkhart Lake. Hi.
Hi. I am at the Sheboygan County Marsh looking at their their purple martin house that's been overrun by the sparrows. And short of, taking down the pole, which I'm not privy to, how do you get rid of the sparrows other than maybe pellet guns? Or, I mean, is there a certain technique, and is it too late in the year to maybe make it available to the purple martins, or what do you suggest for getting rid of the other pest birds?
Yeah, okay, good questions. First of all, if it's overrun with the house sparrows or starlings, it may already be too late for the colony. If the purple martins have been driven out, they may not come back, or it's going to take a real concerted effort. And as you mentioned, this is at a county park. It sounds like somebody was well-meaning, put up a box there, and probably right near the marsh and water, there always was a purple martin colony, but they do need to be effectively managed. Now, purple martin houses commonly have come with a pole that pivots at the bottom so that come fall or winter, you can swing it down, bring it down, and clean it out or take it off or even plug up the holes to keep the house sparrows out. Since those are primarily not migratory birds, the house sparrows and starlings get in there before the martins even arrive here. So as we heard earlier, usually around that mid-late April is when the martins arrive. Well, if you have your box up year-round and have it available, those non-native birds are in there before the martins ever arrive. The real trick is to get a box that telescopes up and down, in other words, with a pulley system. Now, it's a much more elaborate system, a little more expensive and more work. But what you do is you are able then to, with a crank, kind of like what you'd have as a boat winch, to just simply crank that box straight down on the pole, bring it down to your own eye level. And what you want to do is you want it to go straight up and down because the martins home in on which of the cavities is their nest site by where it is oriented to the sun. So you can't twist it around because they will literally get lost as to which cavity their young are in. So what you want to do is you want to watch where the house sparrows or starlings are starting to make a nest, and you want to remove those nests. Now, if you just take the nest material and the eggs out, they're going to rebuild as fast as you can pull it out. The real trick is get rid of the culprit. Now, birds are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, but in 2004, there was a what's called the Migratory Bird Treaty Reform Act, an appendix to that to clarify who was protected by that and who was not.
And you know what? We're going to go take a quick break, look at the news, and then we'll talk some more about that. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. So happy to have you along today on this Memorial Day. I think one of the kind of the interesting and fun things that we do on our holidays is to sort of stress birds. We and Bill Volkert, our guest today, has been doing this for many a year with me and also with Judith, of course, recently as well. She joined the team a couple years back now and has hosted many of those shows with Bill as well. He is here to talk about spring bird watching with you and with me. You can join us with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Open lines, we'll get you on pretty quickly. Email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and we'll get you on the air. And we'll also, if you're going to the Facebook page and have some photos, bird photos, please post them. We'd certainly love to see them. And let's go to the phones now with Rick in Madison. Rick, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I'm calling because I have a couple of ducks that are nesting in a hole in a big old silver maple tree just off of our back deck. And I've seen them go into the hole around dusk. It's pretty dark, so I can't tell. I'm assuming they're wood ducks. But I'm kind of wondering what's going to happen now when the ducklings come out. Will they just leave and then be gone forever? And I'm also curious because we've had squirrels in that hole for the last 10 years, as many as 6 or 7 come out in the spring. And I'm wondering, were they chased out? Did they just leave? Who winds up with that hole? Who decides?
Huh.
Good question. Well, normally squirrels, just because of their bulk, tend to be a little bit more aggressive and get the upper hand on a cavity. Birds, even if something like the size of a wood duck, is still a pretty fragile animal because they have to be so lightweight to be able to fly. So they don't want to get into too much of a fight physically with something like a mammal. It's a little bit more of a risk for them for permanent injury. If they somehow won out over the squirrels, well, first of all, there must be alternative sites for the squirrels, that they found something else and left something for the duck. As far as which species, yeah, wood duck is the most common one using cavities across much of Wisconsin. In some parts of southern Wisconsin and throughout northern Wisconsin, the hooded merganser tends to be a very common cavity nester. And then there are a few birds that are more up into Canada, the common merganser, bufflehead, and goldeneye. Those are also cavity nesting ducks. Now, all of these birds are simply using the cavity as a place to lay the eggs and safely to hatch the young. And what will happen is the young will hatch out pretty much synchronously. So, in other words, like other birds, they lay an egg, one every day or so, and then when their clutch is complete, all the eggs have been laid, then they incubate, so they all hatch on the same day. They'll hatch out over a couple of hours, they'll fluff up and dry off, and then the mother will sit outside, somewhere within about 24 hours of hatching, and call to them. One by one, they climb up to the entrance, they jump out, and they fall to the ground. Fortunately, their bunch are just very lightweight fuzzballs, so they can fall 40, 50, even 60 feet, and they just tend to bounce. The mother will gather them up, and she will then vocalize very softly and lead them to water. The nearby water, which can be up to several hundred yards away or more, that is where there's safety. They're out on water away from most land predators, and that's where the food is. And so they're not going to come back to that. That is just where the eggs are laid and just long enough for them to hatch out. That's all they use it for.
So then they will be going probably to the pond at Odana Golf Course. We live right by the golf course there.
Right.
Now, will they be able to get through our chain link fence? Are they tiny enough they'll just sneak through it?
Now, that may be a bit of a physical barrier. And we do see this every year somewhere that the mother's starting to lead the ducklings. And, oh, it may happen that one of the ducklings ends up in traffic, that they fall down a manhole cover, that they get out somewhere where it's just not a real safe environment, or there's even a physical barrier. What you can do is you may be able to gather the young up fast enough, but the mother has to know that they have not been preyed upon, and you can either help them over or remove that barrier temporarily and help them to get through that and around it. But she wants to keep those young close by and lead them to safety.
Okay, and also we have a dog who spends time in the yard. Do you have any idea when we can look for this, time-wise?
Well, if you know when they actually began to incubate, which is a little tough because they're, first of all, checking. You'll see them going in and out of the hole only. They may be checking it out as a potential nest site. They may eventually settle on it as a site. They'll begin to lay the eggs, and then they incubate. So you don't know when the clutch is complete and when they begin to incubate. But for a wood duck, you're talking somewhere around 20, 22 days of incubation time, as best as I can recall. So you're looking at 3 weeks' time, but they're going in and out of that cavity prior to actually starting to incubate, so it's hard to know when that date begins. I would say somewhere within the next within a few days to certainly the next 2 weeks they'll be coming out. And this whole event may take place within just 5-10 minutes as she calls, and one by one they jump out. She gathers them up and starts walking away with them.
Hmm.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Jeff in Fox Lake, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, good morning. I have a question regarding a northern harrier. I'm aware that they're a ground nester, and what I have is large patches of alfalfa. It's an alfalfa grass mix, and that's got to get mowed for my farming practices. The trouble is, several times now, I've had them nest in there, and I've only ever one time seen it where I could get around it, leaving big enough patch where she can finish the job. Other times, the past two times, I've gone right through it. I'm wondering, when she's sitting, does she ever leave the nest? I had in mind to get some volunteers to try and locate this nest before I got a cut.
Good question. Yes, if you can try to help her, give her that little bit of an island out there and finish rearing the young, that would certainly be a benefit, because this is a bird where populations have been declining, and the lack of good, secure grassland habitat has been a problem for them. Probably the best you can do is, yeah, get a couple of volunteers and just walk across the field and see if you don't see that bird flushing ahead of you.
Okay,
you can get pretty tight to the eggs incubating, but at some point as you're approaching it, she'll most likely flush, and you might be able to find where that nest is located and then flag that for yourself.
Yeah, that's right. The question pertaining to it is, will she leave on her own to get her food, or does the male? Because I see the male around, and I got a feeling she's out there, but it's 20 acres square. I don't. So yeah. You'd have to walk it to try and flush her out.
Yeah, right.
She's not getting up off there 2-3 times a day at all.
The other thing to do, no, the male's bringing the food in because she's incubating.
Yeah,
but
okay,
he will drop food for her. So if you want to watch, if he's flying across and you see he's actually holding a mouse, you watch where he goes, and you'll see him actually do a fast stoop, and he'll drop that food for her and just keep right on going. Earlier in the year, when they're in courtship, they do an amazing thing where they'll actually pass food, and you'll see the male as kind of an offering carrying a mouse, and then she will flip upside down, and he'll pass that over to her as part of the courtship ritual. But no, watch where he's dropping food. See if you can't watch him for a while as he's coming in with food that he's leaving for her.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah. You're thanks, welcome. Jeff. Susan in Lake Geneva. Hello.
Hi there. So I just moved from South Central Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, and my favorite bird and bird song was the wood thrush. I lived in deep woods, however, and I don't now, but there are big trees. I have yet to hear that bird. And I was wondering, aren't there wood thrushes here?
There are, but unfortunately the wood thrush is in a little bit of trouble. It is a population that has been declining over the years. The problem for wood thrushes is they nest in interior forests, and as we've been chopping our forests to make them smaller and smaller, it starts to have additional impacts. They're both losing available habitat, and then it takes on what we call the edge effect. In other words, along the edge of forests is where we have heavier number of predators, the raccoons, the blue jays, which will take the eggs, occasionally crows, and even grackles, which are nest predators, and then the cowbirds that lay its eggs in other birds' nests.
Right.
These are mostly birds that are working the edge of forest and go in about 100 yards at the most on average. By the time we get a woodlot that's only 40 acres in size, it is all edge. So in other words, a wood thrush that is normally deep in a large forest is more vulnerable to these impacts. And so, yeah, the wood thrush is a bird that we do hear less and less of, and there's a lot of work going on trying to figure out what we can do to reverse it, to both give them secure nesting sites here in the north and to see if there's problems in the wintering grounds because they winter in Central America. And
I know they're migratory.
Seems to be the bigger problem is up here, the lack of secure nesting sites for them, and that's a challenge.
What can I do as a homeowner who wants to attract them? Could I? I have big trees. It's not deep woods.
Yeah, that's the problem. You can have, as Kim mentioned earlier, the stopover habitat for them where they'll stop in migration on their way coming north for a day or two to give them an island area to rest. But really, we need to protect the big blocks of forest, such as the Baraboo Hills, the northern and southern Kettle Moraine, and southwest Wisconsin, because the wood thrush is not getting way up into the far northern part of the state either. So it's really in more the southern half of Wisconsin through Illinois and Missouri. And this is an area where really extensive wood forest land is not that available.
Well, I guess I could hear it if I went on a nice hike in the Kettle Moraine woods.
Yes, I was over in the Baraboo Hills, and I heard them singing there in good numbers, which was a real thrill for me. But, you know, you can't put all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. We can't expect here that we're going to take care of an entire population with only one good nesting area in the whole state. So, we've got to protect all the forests that we can.
Thank you.
Well, I sure'd hate to lose that bird, and I thank you so much for your information.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Thor in Washington Island, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I've got an unusual sighting to report.
Okay.
I'm not what you might call an avid birder myself, but Washington Island is a pretty small community, and the most recent sighting caused something of a buzz around there. Over the last 2 weeks, people have been seeing a crested caracara.
Oh.
Crested caracara?
Absolutely.
Very unusual, because this is a bird that is found in Mexico, Central America, Northern South America, and from about far southern Texas over to Florida. There's a small population there. For a bird to have drifted this far north, this would be really extraordinary. I'm not saying it's entirely impossible. You never know, since birds do fly and they may get caught up in winds, but this would be quite the record. Here, I would certainly recommend some good documentation of it. Try to get some good photos, and as we suggested with the nice picture we saw on Larry's Facebook page of the lazuli bunting, photograph it and document it. Go to the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website, look under Rare Bird Report, and submit that so that it becomes a record that we can both evaluate and we get formal documentation and accept it as a rare record for Wisconsin.
You know, actually, it's been all over the, Judith was telling me, it's been all over the Wisconsin Birding Facebook page with photos.
Okay, well, I missed that because I was out birding. I haven't had a chance to look at it myself. So, yeah, I missed the word on that. Yeah, okay, sounds like there'll be probably plenty of documentation. This is a great record for Wisconsin because this bird is way off course.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've also had violet-eared hummingbirds, which are normally found from Mexico south. We had one in Wisconsin. What these things are doing here, who knows?
Yeah. Thanks, Laura.
Well, you're very welcome.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Oh, so the Wisconsin Birding Facebook page, that's the place to go to see the photos. Barb in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, I have a question for you regarding bluebird nesting boxes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How do you deter house sparrows from going in making their nests? And is it true if you remove the eggs that they will come back or go to other areas and destroy nests in the other nesting boxes, or even a brown-headed cowbird, will it go back into that nesting box and destroy the nestlings?
Good question. In fact, this is a pickup because right up to the news, I didn't quite finish on what I was going to suggest for purple martins, and they're very parallel here. Yeah, if you just to take out the nest material in the eggs, they can be pretty persistent, and they can get right back in and rebuild. And sometimes to make sure that there's enough food for their young, they may go into adjacent boxes and actually peck on the eggs to pip them so that they won't hatch, kill the young, or even to kill the adults. And we have found, as we've checked nest boxes, we open them up, and sure enough, there's a dead bluebird in there, and all the young have died of starvation because of house sparrows going in there and just beating on them just to remove the competition. So what you need to do then is remove the adult house sparrow itself. And as I was going to mention earlier, house sparrows and starlings are not native to North America, so they're not protected under the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So in other words, you can't go shooting a woodpecker that's causing a problem to your house. That's a federal violation. But house sparrows and starlings are not protected. And the best thing to do is go at nighttime. Because during the day, they'll see or hear you coming, and they'll shoot out, and leave behind the nest and its eggs. You remove it, and they're right back in there starting all over, and that'll keep you as busy as them all summer long.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do is go at nighttime, open the box up, and remove the adult itself. I know that this can be difficult for people, but the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin has made it, this was a difficult thing among the committee, but they made it a policy recommendation that if you're going to have a successful bluebird trail, you need to aggressively remove those non-native competitors because it's going to be one or the other, and more often than not, it'll be the non-native birds to win out. And I've heard about people with purple martin colonies the same way. I don't want to harm the house sparrows and starlings. Well, then you might as well take the box down because they're going to win out, and you're martins are going to lose out just as well.
Do the brown-headed cowbirds come back if you take the eggs out?
Now, normally your cowbird shouldn't be getting in there because the hole should be too small for them to squeeze into. Go to the Bluebird Restoration Association website, take a look at their plans for the bluebird boxes, and normally the hole for the size of a bluebird and a tree swallow is a little small for a cowbird to squeeze into.
Hmm. So, I thought they were. Maybe they weren't because I didn't have the best picture.
They sometimes can get into that, but it's quite a tight squeeze for them. But there again, if you're checking your boxes about every 7 to 10 days, you'll be able to get in there, find that alien egg, so to speak, and remove it. And that way the bluebirds can carry on and they can rear their own young without having the parasitic nester, the cowbird, hatching out and taking away all the food from the bluebirds.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the good news for that nesting box, we took the eggs out, and 4 of the 5 eggs hatched Saturday, the bluebirds.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah, so.
Now we always have to have them successfully rear them to fledging, and that should take another 2 weeks or so, and then the young should be flying out, and they may have plenty of time to start a second batch for the summer.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. You know, we were talking about orchard orioles earlier, and we've gotten all kinds of calls and comments. Gloria in Northern Shawnee, she had her first male orchard school in her yard for the orchard oriole, excuse me, in her yard for the first time ever this spring. Julia from Mondovi Also had orchard orioles for the first time. And the first week of May, they came. And Suzanne from Mequon said she's had a pair of nesting orchard orioles for at least 20 years in Mequon.
Well, that's, again, more in the southern part of the state.
Yep.
So it's a little closer to the range. But we're getting reports from a lot of other widespread areas. So, yeah, this is a population that's on the move. And as we said earlier, it used to be an incredibly rare sighting. And now it's fairly commonplace in a lot of areas.
Yeah, very cool. And lots more great photos on Facebook, on the Facebook page. And, Bill, you had your bird-a-thon day. We should just take a minute.
I was hoping to get a minute before we're all done here to talk a little about the bird-a-thon. It was a real pleasure. I was able to help out the Natural Resources Foundation in their fundraising, and this is money that is going for bird conservation projects. So there were a number of teams all over the state who ran a bird-a-thon to raise money. I had a lot of generous people who put up money for my day, and I chose on Sunday, May 18th, and I took Horicon Marsh. So primarily one single property. I got out there at 4 o'clock in the morning so that I could already start to tick off some of those birds that sing in the dark. So first thing I had was woodcock and henslow sparrows and marsh wrens and American bitterns calling before the sun came up. And once the morning got going, the birds were coming to life. I then moved to the uplands to where the songbirds were. I came across the marsh areas to look for water birds and others. And I took a little bit of a break in the midday since I got up so early and then went out again for the late afternoon. I ended up with 133 species, which is not a record for Horicon, but certainly not a bad day. It was a really fun day. And I should mention, if anybody is interested in still supporting, you can go to WisconsinBirdathon.org, and you can still go to their website and do a pledge to help them out. And that money is going to a number of projects, the Stopover Initiative that Kim is working on, the Kirtland's Warbler Project, a number of very important bird conservation projects. They're trying to raise $75,000 of private money to go to these special bird conservation efforts. And I was glad to be able to help them out.
Yeah, that's just wonderful. And just to mention here in our last 30 seconds or so that you're going to be with Kim at a conference, Grosbeaks Galore in Ashland this coming Saturday.
Yes, the 31st, we'll be up there for the landowner workshop, and registration is still open through Wednesday for anybody who's looking for a way to improve their backyard and their land to manage for our migratory birds and to help them out.
And Kim said if you wanted to register directly with her, you could call her at area code 608-264-8594. That's 608-264-8594. And that sounded like a whole lot of fun. And Bill, I know it's going to be great with you there. And I thank you so much for taking time on this Memorial Day to be with us again. So that's about 27 years we've been doing.
It's been a long time, but it's been wonderful. And we can't say enough about birds. We love them, and I know there's a lot of people out there who enjoy them and care about them and help us to take good care of them.
Thanks, Bill.
You're welcome.
Bill Volker, naturalist, retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. He'll be back. We'll talk with him again. Tomorrow at 11, the Wisconsin Energy Institute will be talking about some research on electric vehicles that range from lightweight commuters to an all-electric pickup. And then our weather guys come by at 11:45, talk about weather. And thank you for listening. I hope you have a great rest of the Memorial Day. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network.